Okay.
This is the April 10th, 2018 Statutory Interpretation Way Trade Practice class. And we are now deep into the final third of the course talking about administrative law and practice. So think about our last class last week where we took our first deep dive into administrative law. And since it was our first visit, not surprisingly, we spent time on fundamentals, basic blocking and tackling. So we talked about fundamental questions, which do come up in practice. These are not just idle exercises. What is an agency? Which triggers which federal units and state units are covered by the Administrative Procedure Act, for example. We talked a little bit about what is a rule, and what are examples of rules, and what sorts of things the Administrative Procedure Act does not subject to full rulemaking requirements, things such as interpretive rules or general statements of policy. Let me plant a small flag for you to think about and plan ahead. One very active issue in this, which has enormously occupied the time of the Trump administration, is rules versus guidances. A guidance is simply an internal agency statement as to how they plan in the future to interpret a statute or a rule. It doesn't bind or apply or affect anyone individually directly in that circumstance, but it's a big signal for future actions that the agency may take. How is that functionally distinct from a rule? There are very strong objections to the increased use of guidance by agencies to accomplish goals as a substitute for rulemaking. And how you draw that line has become a very active debate, in particular Department of Justice. So we'll talk about more on that later in the semester. I wanted to let you start thinking about that issue because it is actively engaging a lot of practitioners right now. So bottom line, as I reminded everyone, I just want to say it again, this is where the action is for most attorneys. I hope some of you spend a lot of time in court. I hope many of you become criminal defense attorneys and argue passionately before juries. But I'll just tell you the blunt truth is that 80% of most lawyers are occupied almost entirely by work before agencies of various varieties. So this is a good thing to have in your pocket when you go out to practice. Now, if that's the case, the Administrative Procedure Act is the roadmap for that practice. It's called the Magna Carta in your textbook. That's actually pretty true. I can't tell you how many times the APA pops up in discussions about agency action at a federal level. Having said that, there's a small Easter egg, and I didn't mention this to you, but when you look in the appendix of your copy of the Administrative Procedure Act, there's a whole nother statute buried inside of it, embryonically. The Freedom of Information Act is technically part of the APA. And many of you may know about FOIA, but FOIA basically is your statutory right to demand any information you want from a federal agency. I just got a complaint this morning put on my desk from a group that is trying to subpoena all records of the Environmental Protection Agency dealing with its decision to rescind fuel efficiency standards for cars. They don't have to basically file a lawsuit to get information. They don't have to do discovery. Under FOIA, they're entitled to it. And if the agency balks, they can sue. So with that in mind, we talked also, I made a glancing comment that's worth reminding you about the difference between independent and executive agencies and some of the hallmarks for independent agencies. Recall we just had a brief talk on that. So last comments or questions before I talk a little bit more review in APA. That's all familiar, refresh. You guys have it all ingrained. You know, the law professor responds to that kind of question and say, well, what do you think? But I'm not going to do that to you unless you want me to. Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, my confusion area is, so the independent agency is created by Congress and run by Congress, or is created by, it's not created by Congress,
it's created by Congress almost every time. Okay. The whole point of an independent agency is that it's independent of executive branch influence and congressional influence, frankly. The idea is designing an agency from the ground up so that's resistant to the tides of political influence.
Both executive and congressional, or just executive?
Mostly executive, but to some extent congressional as well. So that's why you have multiple commissioners. That's why you have overlapping terms. You might have requirements that come from different parties. You might have restrictions on the ability to fire them or their underlings. All those are hallmarks of independent agencies. Okay? Any others? Okay, so dropping it down a notch, the Administrative Procedure Act. Remind yourselves, these are important thoughts. The Administrative Procedure Act sets out the roadmap of how agencies take actions, including the way they do almost all of their binding work, which is passing rules. And what we had basically, remember the matrix, formal and informal action, and rulemaking and adjudicatory action. And you can have blends of each of those. The one that we are going to spend most of our time on, because it is the vast, overwhelming majority of actions, is informal rulemaking. You can have informal enforcement adjudicatory proceedings, but you know, we'll talk more about formal as well next week. But the bottom line here is I want you to think about rulemaking. That's where most of your work will be. And then we did sort of the standard timeline on how agencies create rules. If y'all remember roughly about how those worked, sort of like it's chronological. You have basically the rule bakes inside the agency. Then the agency has a notice of proposed rulemaking. It invites comments during a specific period of time to create a record. When that record closes, the agency takes the proposal back behind closed doors, and then it crafts a final rule and a preamble that responds to the comments and alters the final rule in response to those comments. That's the stripped down basics. And we talked about ways you can advocate within those frameworks. Any questions about those so far? Because we're going to start talking about how they actually get implemented and reviewed by the judiciary today.
Changes in the final rule, do they have to explain those changes, or is that all agreed?
If there are material changes to the rule, usually they have to either repropose the rule or they have to explain why the rule has changed. And there has to be essentially fair notice that the rule could have been changed that way. What you can't do is propose a rule, get a substantive comment, and then propose a totally different rule so that no one had a chance to comment on it. All right. Okay. So with that, a few last looks back as we move along. I wanted to remind everyone that the APA is both a floor and a ceiling for procedure. Courts are not free to take that stripped-down model I've subscribed to you and add on to it and say, we want more looks, more higher standards of judicial scrutiny, or more process because we think it's fair. The statute is Congress's word on how agencies should pass rules, and it limits the ability of the courts to demand more. That's the Vermont Yankee case I mentioned briefly. Okay, and then final last points. One is a road sign, the other one is just a reminder. The road sign is everything we've talked about with the APA and everything we've talked about in review of regulations being promulgated has been tweaked in significant ways in the past year. So on Thursday of next week, I'm going to talk through how other statutes have turned the meter on the way we pass rules. For example, executive orders requiring two rules be drawn for every new one that you propose. Talk about the Regulatory Flexibility Act, which gives essentially the Congress the ability to claw back rules. So be prepared, you have the basics, but there are some significant alterations at the margins. And then the second, this is the part that I just want to make sure you don't forget because I covered it fairly briefly. All the APA procedure I've described to you and all the way agencies implement it then gets packaged and shipped for another very important review step, which is internal. And that is the process under the Office of Management and Budget under executive orders, where the president has basically said you can't promulgate a rule unless its benefits outweigh its cost. Executive Order 12866. That one goes back to Clinton days, and it's still the guideline for how OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, reviews rules. The smallest, most influential agency none of us have ever heard of is the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs, OIRA. They're the ones who actually take these rules and make sure that the benefits outweigh the cost. OMB and OIRA have the ability to basically hold up rules. They don't think, I'm sorry, Jack, I was barreling along. What'd you say?
No, I'm not gesturing my hand, so you didn't miss anything. What functionally is the difference between OIRA and OMB?
OIRA is within OMB.
Okay.
So OMB has a much wider portfolio of responsibilities, including preparing a budget. OIRA specifically zeroes in on whether rules meet the standards set by the executive branch.
Okay, thank you.
So circling back, they, OIRA can basically take a rule that an agency wants to promulgate and say, try again. They can essentially issue a letter that demands the agency redo the calculation to address their concerns. OIRA also has the ability to issue what's called a prompt letter saying, agency, get off your butt. This is something you should be regulating. And we're going to push you to do that. It's not binding the agency, but it usually gets a lot of attention. So that process can hold up rules, particularly politically controversial rules, for years. Unless there's a statutory mandate, those rules essentially circle the holding pattern until OIRA is satisfied. Okay, so with that in mind, I left you with some parting thoughts to think about, some knotty questions that come up again and again. What is the value of a life in this process? Does it matter whose life it is? One of the most controversial actions OIRA ever considered was giving less monetary value to lives of persons who were elderly. Since they weren't going to live as long, their economic value was less. Do children get a higher value, even though they're not working and earning income? What do you do about non-monetary injuries? For example, your book has a wonderful review exercise on the Prison Rape Elimination Act. How do you measure the value of that avoided harm? What's the price tag? Do you take a survey? Do you see what settlements are paid in court judgments? Those are very difficult issues. OMB and OIRA actually have rough metrics on what value to accord to human lives. And it varies, but agencies tend to have different standards, and it varies according to what the mission of the statute is. All right, deep breath. So that's the review. Any questions about those fundamental building blocks of administrative law practice? Yes, I think I gave this plug last class. If you find this interesting, I've only given you the first step into it. Administrative law is a class that has a reputation, at least when I was in law school, of being excruciating. Bless you. Wow. Now you just completely blew me off my train of thought. Administrative law is worth taking, especially Professor Kumar. And second, now that we're going to talk about all of that, I want you to take it and apply it in your heads to our example of the transgenic mosquitoes. If you're an agency and you're worried that we're about to have a Zika outbreak in Houston, have any of you seen the photos of the children born after the mother's been infected with Zika? Yeah. I mean, it's heartrending. It's unbelievable what damage it does to children. You want to do something about it. How do you use the regulatory state? How do you use the Administrative Procedure Act to get there? And Gabriel, were you just stretching or raising your hand?
I was stretching.
Okay. That's a dangerous thing to do in this class, don't you think? All right. Let's pick an agency. I'm not going to say the Food and Drug Administration. You want to have these mosquitoes released into the environment as an insecticide, the same way you'd spray a crop to put down a pest. What would you do? Very quickly. What's the most effective way for an agency to promulgate a legally enforceable course of action? Thank you, Roy. I'm almost tempted to give you swag for breaking the ice in class today. But I don't know, I only have super micro swag or something like that. But since we're talking about puzzles and process, this is a small puzzle. Don't spend the rest of the class trying to work it. Okay, promulgate the rule. We've talked about that. So the agency takes it inside, they consider what process, what procedure, what rule would be the most effective? And then they announce the proposed rule. So we are reading the Federal Register and shazam. We see a notice that the agency has proposed a rule that would allow the release of transgenically modified mosquitoes in Harris County in response to perceived fears of Zika outbreaks, determined solely, let's just make this up, by the FDA. They decide when to release them, they decide when there's an epidemic risk, they decide how many mosquitoes to release, they decide where in Harris County they get released. Solely driven by the metric of reducing the risk of an epidemic. All right, the rule's out there. What happens next?
Comment.
I have bad news for everybody. Remember the notice I sent to everybody in class, I handed out? The comment period closed yesterday. If you didn't submit a comment, you were out of luck. The brutal truth is that the agency is not required to consider any comments submitted outside of the period of periods of submission. That's it. So if you miss the deadline, you have two things. One, you have no footing to approach the agency and claim it acted arbitrarily by not considering your late comment. And two, you've got a great malpractice lawsuit with your client against you. Just like a court filing, statute of limitations deadline, you can't miss these. So the comment, you can submit in any format, any form. It could be an onion skin paper and crayon. It could be a 3,000 foot tome. It's entirely up to you. Then, once you've got that submitted, the agency has to process it. And then we see a final rule, typically. And the final rule says, we decide to release these transgenic mosquitoes. Boom, you're done. It's published in the Federal Register with a lengthy preamble explaining why, and considering the evidence and comments it received, and how it changed the final rule in response to them, but that the delta between the proposed rule and the final rule is not so great that people didn't get a chance to comment on the final rule.
Let's say you make a comment within the time period, and then they announce the final rule, and it does not include whatever your comment asked for it to include. Is that stage of the process open to litigation, or is it the rule didn't include what you thought it should?
I'm going to chuckle eagerly. You've given us a great transition to the Nova Scotia case, which is our first case. Hold on. I'm not putting you on the hook for it unless you want to.
I don't care.
Okay. Although, I'm sorry. Okay, but you're quite correct. Once the final rule comes out, that starts the clock for when you can file a lawsuit. Unless the federal statute dictates where you have to file under a venue provision, the APA gives you some flexibility as to where you file, but they tend to be filed either in the location where the action would take place, so here maybe the Fifth Circuit or the D.C., the Southern District of Texas, or the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, because that's where the agency's at. Fatima, I'm sorry.
Is there a certain systematic way that certain comments are prioritized more than others? Like, for example, about the regulations, would the comments given by
a
medical agency be prioritized over another agency?
You want to get the legal answer or the real answer?
The real answer.
Legally, they're all the same. The real answer is absolutely. Agencies can tell which comments come from truly expert groups that have insights they receive from WAC, which comments come from politically powerful players who they ignore at their peril, which ones come from people who have a particular interest in it, who are going to be most affected by them. For example, a rule affecting tribal lands. There's no manual, there's no rules, there's no specific framework that says these count, these don't, but I'll tell you, in the real world, absolutely. The agencies sort out pretty quickly the ones they view that have substantive comments, and the rest get resolved and answered usually in a technical appendix that's buried in the record someplace else. So doctors typically, for healthcare things like transgenic mosquitoes, they would have a huge spot in the comment period. Sorry, first.
Didn't you say by the time you get to like the comment portion that you're kind of out of luck?
Well, I think you've missed an opportunity. You can still have an influential role, but it's harder than it. It's picture a giant asteroid going towards the Earth. You get it early, a small alteration puts it off the track that will hurt the Earth. The closer it gets, the harder it is. Okay, and I'm sorry.
Is there a different process for people who are going to, for organizations that are going to submit, like, let's say, 3,000 word page document with pictures and all that? Because every time I'm about to make a comment, you know, they give you that little comment box. So is there another avenue? Can they send it directly to the person? They don't have to do it through the web page?
Well, I'd say electronically, you can actually attach and upload documents.
Okay.
But also, you don't have to use it. It's still perfectly legal, perfectly appropriate to print out a large, hardbound copy and walk it over and plop it on their desk.
Okay, that's an official comment.
That's an official comment. So we've gotten to the important question now. The rule is out. What do we want to do if we think this rule screws it up? So today's topic is judicial review of agency action. We're starting really the meat of our last third of the class. Now, having said that, before we leave it behind, put aside the readings for a second. Just be smart for yourselves. I'm asking for you to use your judgment, your creativity, your evil instincts. Given the insight of the system we just have here, how would you game it? If there was a rule coming out that you wanted to stop death in its tracks, what sorts of things you might do? Emily?
I'm
going to
make the comment period from Christmas to New Year's. So that everyone's busy, nobody's going to comment on the rule.
That is evil. Usually, though, you're required to have at least 30 days, unless it's an emergency rulemaking. But even so,
December 15th to January 15th.
You'd be surprised how many rules get done in that circumstance.
Flood the comment section with comments or stuff from like bots or something like that.
So, like Flack, basically. Essentially, if you had 1 or 2 million comments submitted in a rule, it becomes incredibly difficult for the agency to respond. You're absolutely dead on. I suspect that you have a secret hankering to be an administrative lawyer because the Waters of the United States rule, which I was involved with, 6 million comments. And those were not necessarily bot comments, but a lot of them were advocacy groups go to their members and say, send this postcard or hit send on this email. So you get a lot of comments that look exactly the same. The agency just scoops them together and says, here's one response to 5 million comments.
You hired the same web developers that did healthcare.gov, so no, you never on site.
That is especially evil but painful. I'm sorry, I see another hand over here. Oh, Jeff?
Yeah, I was going to say, if you want your proposed rule to have a bunch of credibility, get the other agencies on board with you before you do it. So like in the mosquito case, it's an FDA thing, but you'd want to get, if it's in Texas, you'd want to get also the EPA, TCQ, anybody else.
Absolutely. That's if you want the rule to pass. So
you,
no, both sides. How do you manipulate, I said, game the system? That works both directions. You're absolutely correct. And there's a, remember that incubation period that I talked about? That's exactly when you do that sort of coalition building. And what you'd ask is each of those agencies to support by submitting comments on the very rule, even if they're participating in it. Any others? Mike?
Citizen, I didn't know nothing about any rules being passed, but if somebody were to put something in front of me that I either agree with or disagree with, to want to agree, I would be much more likely to try to say something.
Fair enough, but that now we're veering more from law towards politics, I'll suggest. But you're right, most legislative attorneys have, most shops in D.C. actually have a portion of their staff dedicated to public relations and press. And the most effective ones get the message out.
Frame it in a way that it's a guideline or procedural rule or a policy or something, so you don't have to
ruling
at all.
Oh, I like that one. It has its advantages, it has its disadvantages. The advantage is it's stealth. It flies under the radar. No one really knows about it. The guidance shows up on a website somewhere. The problem is it cuts both ways. I want the cover of a formal rule to authorize my action of releasing mosquitoes. If I'm going out there with my truck and someone gets an injunction against me, all I've got is a guidance that has no legal effect to justify my action. So I like guidances. Guidances have their place. We'll talk about guidances. There's a certain threshold where you actually might want them. Okay, probably one or two more. Absolutely. The appropriations committees are brilliant at using sniper shots, where they will not only say, you can't develop this rule, they will say, no dollar shall be spent in the development of this particular rule by these particular people during this particular time. And they close their books and go home. There's nothing else you can do at that point. It's very effective. Last one, Drew.
What are the rules for changing what's in the proposed rules after the comment period, and then do you have to resubmit it for comment, or can you kind of sneak some stuff in there after public comment?
The rule is squishy. Did everyone hear Drew's question? how far can you go? What is the rule, excuse me, on a, the ability to change a rule before you actually have to then re-propose it? If I capture that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. So
okay.
In that final stage, when you come out with the final rule, how different can that be from the one that was submitted for a public comment?
There's no bright line. The bottom line is that if the rule is changed enough so that it is materially altered for the proposed rule in a way that the public did not have fair notice of that change, then you have to re-propose it. So how do agencies gain that? They say, here's the rule we'd like to propose. Here is alternative A, and they might spend two paragraphs. And we invite comment on this alternative. And they might have B, C, and D. And then if they pick and choose from those that they gave fair notice of, oftentimes that's enough to say that the public got an opportunity to comment on it, and that's good. What they can't do is say, you like option A, they get comments that say option A is a terrible idea, so then they say option Z, and they don't give any fair notices to that substantive material change. So unfortunately, I can't sort of give you black and white as to where that line might be.
Okay, but that's what I do.
Okay. All right, so you guys have gotten an idea. It's a flexible system. It was one that was written and designed actually back in the 1940s. So it's got a lot of history behind it. But it's also one that is starting to show signs of age in the new era. It's been updated to include electronic commenting and compilation of records. But you may recall Marcella Burke mentioned it's come under siege. Not only are we getting 6 million comments from individuals, we're getting flooded by mechanized comments. And right now the agency is trying to figure out how do you parse through millions and millions of comments, some of which are generated by spam bots. And it's incredibly difficult to figure out which are legitimate concerns and which are basically anti-aircraft flak designed to gum up the system. So with that in mind, congeal it in your head. It's all now in a big piece. Step back. You're now a judge. You've been presented with a rule that someone hates. Someone doesn't want transgenic mosquitoes released in Harris County. They view it as a perversion of nature. They view it as a wildly untested risk. They view it as something that the public should have an opportunity to have a say as to when and where and how they're released. They're worried about mosquitoes becoming Franken-mosquitoes. All sorts of concerns. So how does the judiciary essentially exercise oversight on this administrative rule development process? And that's our topic for today. So with that in mind, once again, before we dive into our two cases, number one, as always, start with the Administrative Procedure Act, Section 702 and Section 706. Section 702 specifies that there is a presumption of judicial reviewability. Does that sound familiar? And you're thinking, wait, there's a canon that says that. Notice that, and we'll talk about more, this was meant to embody that presumption in a statutory form. Second, Section 706 spells out what the standard of review is when a court looks at a rule. We'll talk about what that standard is in our cases today, but the bottom line is you're going to hear the phrase repeatedly in this class and for the rest of your law school career, arbitrary, capricious, and otherwise not in accordance with law. Bless you. Okay, so notice what that doesn't include. It doesn't include the fact that Congress can say, whoa, no, we don't want judicial review of this. So you can have carve-outs from presumption of judicial review. And I can tell you from experience, Congress does it. And it has billion-dollar consequences. But they can simply say, this decision will not get to the courts now or later. Number two, never forget, states have their own Administrative Procedure Acts. I'm guilty of this. It's a first-year class, so perhaps there's some justification for it. But the state is where a lot of your work is going to be, if not most of it, and the state has its own Administrative Procedure Act, which differs from our process. It has a rulemaking comment process that looks a lot the same. Judicial review standards are different. I just want to alert you that that's the case. All right, and then last, to invoke judicial review, the statute, the Administrative Procedure Act, says all you need to have is essentially some form of legal injury or some interest affected by the rule. A lot of people think that means anybody can sue. And that's not the case. If you're suing in federal court, you still have to satisfy Article 3 standing requirements. You still have to be someone who actually has a concrete, particularized injury resulted from that rule. There's some very interesting twists and turns as to what a procedural injury looks like, but for now, Article 3 still applies. All right, so with that in mind, yes, sorry, Brian.
What was number one?
Say it again.
What was number one? Sorry.
The first step.
Yes.
Start with the APA.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, remember, APA defines what the standard review is and where how it takes place.
Section 702 gives a presumption of judicial review. Is that what you were asking?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so very briefly, again, just to make this realistic, and I do want to spend only a couple minutes on this because I want to get to Nova Scotia, and most importantly, I want to get to State Farm. Flag, posted, highlighted, underlined, read in your book. That is a keystone case. State Farm is one of the cases you will see cited repeatedly. It is one that will show up in this class again. It will show up in your other classes. It is one that is currently before the Supreme Court under multiple initiatives from the Trump administration. That case matters. It's one you should know by hand. So with that heavy-handed preview, think for 30 seconds. If you're a judge and someone sues and says, I hate this rule, think about the nature of the job you've got in front of you. You are going to have to essentially second guess an agency. Isn't that the heart of the issue here? How do you effectively judicially review decisions that are a result of years of rulemaking efforts, thousands if not millions of comments, highly complex technical submissions? The judiciary, to a certain extent, lacks certain core things they need to be able to do that. They don't have the competence. I use that in a neutral value way. They just don't have the expertise or skills to duplicate the judgment of the administrative agency. They don't have the resources to hold months-long trials to create an independent evidentiary record to either probe or supplement the administrative record. They don't have, essentially, the time to go through all the different rules that agencies promulgate. So, as a result, the Administrative Procedure Act specifies a judicial review standard and a process for going through it. But the courts have created a separate framework that gives them a realistic ability to be able to take a look at rules without essentially drowning in the process. I wanted you to have that perspective, that viewpoint, because it drives a lot of the cases we're about to talk about. Otherwise, this sort of seems a bit of a muddle. It's a little mysterious. This is the judiciary's way to find a crafting of their role in a way that can match the demands of reviewing administrative action. So, does that make sense for everybody? Does anyone think I'm full of it when I say that? Because that's not a rule. It's not in a case. That's just my interpretation. Okay, I'm taking that to be universal agreement. And that brings us to our two cases that demonstrate the way judicial review works with administrative rulemaking. The first one is Nova Scotia. You know, United States versus Nova Scotia Foods. Now, I'm going to pause. You do not have to do this one if you want to speak on it. It's up to you.
Well, I can't give you a history of smoked fish, but I can tell you, of course, that.
All right, I will give a 5-second window if anyone else would like to step in because they really love whitefish. 5, 4, 3, 2. Okay. I will also ask for a volunteer for State Farm, so if anyone is interested in picking that one up, I will tell you that would be time well spent because that case, I probably shouldn't say this to you, but I will guarantee you will pop up on the file in some form or fashion. Okay, so I guess then you get the swag.
Oh, cool.
You should see it before you say that.
Well, it's my first time, so.
Well, you're lucky, because what I wanted to get was a McDonald's fish filet.
Oh, I see.
That would be good.
Okay. Well, the problem with the fish fillet is that the whole class would smell like fish afterwards. But it is whitefish.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. So with that in mind, let's get everyone on the same page. What's going on in the Nova Scotia Foods case?
All right. So the FDA, pursuant to its authority under the FDCA, has issued regulations surrounding the procedure for smoked fish. They say that it needs to be controlled by heat process and all this stuff. But the appellant says that the regulation is valid because it goes beyond the scope of the FDA's authority. They improperly relied on undisclosed evidence, so they didn't improperly inform the appellants of evidence they used to form final rule. And it's not, the regulation is not supported by the administrative record. And finally,
Before you go further, what? Yes. Put a small halt here, because I had to do a reality check looking through the rest of the room. How many of you thought this was the most boring case you've ever read in your entire law school career so far?
that's not true.
Oh, there are worse ones?
Well, I thought the one about the drug dude making a contract on a napkin is boring.
Okay, that's fair. It's fair. I'll just simply say contracts on napkins have a long and noble history in Texas.
Yeah, they do.
Okay. All right. I just wanted to share with everybody, I'm actually encouraged. When I've done that question in the past, like a third of the class raises their hand. This one actually has some flavor to it. It's very briefly. I know. That was intentional. Whitefish, actually, all of you eat, whether you wanted to or not, that's fish sticks. That's fish fillets in your school cafeterias. It's your fish fillet from McDonald's. It is the ultimate bland white fish, as it sounds. Now, here's the catch. When they catch it, sorry, that was unexpected. I'm gonna do it against myself on that one. All right. If you put it through the process that Josh just described, white fish turns into jello. You can't eat it. It turns into a goop if you put it to the temperature standards the FDA wanted. The FDA had created this temperature standard to kill botulism germs. I assume all of us know what botulism is. You know what happens to you when you get botulism? It's one of the most gruesome ways to die. It's pretty awful. It's also, I think, still invariably fatal once you actually develop some of this disease. So I shouldn't say, I'm not sure about that. You may get a survival liquid diet. But it's lockjaw. It's terrible. Actually, but I don't know with your medical training right now if I'm capturing this correctly.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the decisions. It's basically a descending paralysis.
Did everyone hear that? Descending paralysis. It's like being stunned by a spider and you just feel your whole body going numb. Anyway, it's truly awful. So the FDA came up with standards to govern all seafood. And this was guaranteed safe. You bake the hell out of it. That's the standard. The problem is, it essentially tells the whitefish industry to pack up and go home. So there are high stakes here. This is a big deal. So having said that, now the court is presented with the issue. If I could ask you one quick question. This is one of those rare cases that's not a Supreme Court case. So which court, what's the date?
This is from 1977.
And I won't tell you what I was doing in 1977, but I suspect a lot of you were not doing very much in 1977, if I'm correct. Oh, wow.
I said I was following the fish around.
Oh, okay. The P-H-I-S.
Yes.
Make sure. Okay. It's sad that I got that. Anyway, so.
Does only regulate whitefish violate the Equal Protection Clause?
Yeah. Now, that one's grown worse, but so, it's an early case. It's a circuit court case. This is a moment in time. That's what I wanted to emphasize for you. This is when the federal courts were beginning to engage with some of the most technical, modern rulemaking processes. So as a result, read this with an eye towards they're grappling with issues that, frankly, don't get discussed in later cases because everyone already knows the answers. This is your chance to see the courts thinking through these issues. So having with that, you said that there were grounds for the
basis. There were three complaints that Nova Scotia has. The second part of the second one was that the regulation is not supported by the administrative record.
Okay.
That's important because the court talks about how reviewing, the only thing that they use to review is the administrative record as it is. Like, at the time, they don't use whatever the reviewing courts, like the evidence and stuff, which the reviewing courts find. So the lack of presence in the administrator support.
Absolutely. Can I pounce on you for a second, though?
Sure.
Because everyone, I don't know if you're taking notes right now, write that one down. That is at the heart of every single challenge to administrative rulemaking. It's not supported by the record. It's almost rote. Now, the reason that's important is twofold. Remember, you only get review of final agency action. Final agency action is supported by the record, and that's it. You don't get to do discovery on what other rationales might support that rule. You don't get to introduce affidavits for congressional testimony. What's in the record is all you got. That has consequences. It means you get your stuff into the record, but it also means if the agency screws up and they forget to put something in the record and they know it, it doesn't help. You can't post hoc add to the record. You can't create the record after the fact. It sounds obvious, but you would be surprised how many times agencies try to essentially, I hate to say this, doctor the record by adding late filings once the record period is closed. So with that in mind, how did they? What was the record like in this case?
Well, in this case, Nova Scotia says it's not an adequate statement that establishes the basis of the recommendation. And in this case, the court found the regulation, they validated the regulation and the procedure followed in the promulgation of the regulation. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that they don't like the fact that they're going for procedural stuff is the court's attempt to circumvent any factual discussion or any issue of fact. Because okay. If they can find that procedure was invalidated or there are serious concerns with the procedure, then without ever getting into the science.
Actually, I'd like to take that flash briefing. Come back in a second. Yeah, the whole idea of why the court would go after procedure rather than the actual call by the agency. But I was asking in a way after a fact that's really kind of buried in this case. I noticed. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, did they say that they didn't have any records? There was no administrative record.
That's what I'm. That's it. This is not a case of an inadequate record. This is not a case of a record that they didn't respond to. This is a case where they didn't have a record at all. Not on this issue. When this lawsuit got filed, it's interesting to read the history of this case. There was a mad scramble. They were trying to create a record for this vague rulemaking after the fact by assembling scientific data that they happened to have in their drawers, by adding affidavits from rulemakers within the FDA saying, here's what we were thinking at the time, and essentially rationalize the rule after the fact. So to a certain extent, I want to flag this for you because this is one of those other important keystone things about the administrative process and rules and advocacy. You are not allowed to make a decision based on anything other than the contemporary record on the bottom. It usually means that the agency can proceed directly to final rulemaking without responding to comments. There is a record in the sense that there was the original proposed rule, which is itself part of the record. But there's nothing to respond to. The agency doesn't have to go through any kind of rationalization or explanation. The other thing, kind of just buried in all this, the agency's full of experts. They know a lot of this stuff. Should they have to type out everything they know? The The Nova Scotia case walks a fine line there. They say they're allowed to rely on their expertise, but they still nonetheless have to connect the dots and explain why they reached the conclusions they did and explain how their expertise led to that.
Doesn't it also say they can't just, when readily available, they can't just arbitrarily exclude the research or studies that aren't on point with regards to like the Boulder issue, or at the very least they need to explain? I guess that's the record issue, right? But
right,
the court says that in this case, there was readily available research, and the agency was not relying on special expertise, and the availability of that expertise or the expert's research, like you can't just ignore it without any justification or explanation as to why is it for holding.
I can only tell you what I read into that decision, which is that remember the way the FDA scrambled to respond. They basically bottom-dumped all their studies into the record.
Yes.
After that, some of those included studies which they did not discuss in their explanation. Right. So they chose their friends out of the docket and ignored the others. But they're in the docket nonetheless. So if you're asking whether or not there's another study floating around out there that people know about but they just chose not to respond to, that's not quite the same.
Yeah, I'm talking about where the court says that the agency may not have been held to consider all the relevant factors or it says the FDA's own regulations not specifically require every notice local label in reference to all the data and information relied on in the proposal. That we're saying the same thing.
Yeah, I think so. They going back to Drew's original question, they can parse out which are the material comments they need to respond to because they invoke germane issues. But they don't have to go and answer every single comment.
Sure, but if it's like expert comments. Specifically on point, they can't just be like, oh, it's a random comment that we don't need to respond to.
But if they invite judicial reversal, they did. I'm sorry for Johnson.
Yeah. My question was, if there wasn't a record, why would the court allow them to construct a record and put it in the same way?
They didn't allow them. The agency prepared it in special litigation and locked it up. So the court was basically saying, yeah. All right, others? Okay, so that was rationale number one, the record was either non-existent or I'm trying to resist adjectives I shouldn't, but basically failed to do the job because it wasn't contemporaneous. So, but there's a second ground as well. It's not just the record. And I'm tempted to barrel ahead a little bit because I want to start at State Farm. So Josh, I rather than torture you, I'll say this and you can jump in as we go through it. In addition to the insufficiency of the record, the agency is also required to offer a statement explaining why they reached the conclusions they did based on that record. For those who do securities law, it's sort of like the statement of management at the end of a securities filing. It's meant to be an overview that gives an insight into what the agency's thinking was. And here, the agency offered up a justification which didn't connect the dots. In a way, it's the same issue with the record, but extrapolated to the way it affected the thinking of the agency. Because the agency did not have a clear rationale based on a record that would justify its action, the court struck it down on the independent ground that its rationale offered for the rule was also legally inadequate. So, does that make sense for everybody? Because I want to draw a grand conclusion here. Oh, what? Sorry? Yes.
Sorry, I just have a question.
Sure.
So, is that what they include in the preamble? Is that like the addressing of the comments, or is it different?
It's actually, there's a rough equivalence. 503 is a statutory requirement. It tends to be fulfilled by the preamble, but it doesn't mandate that it has to be. Does that help? Yes?
So, they seem to offer, instead of just saying you didn't make a contemporaneous record, therefore, your ruling process is invalid. To come out of this like since you didn't give the test that you were using, people couldn't make relevant comments, and you didn't address all the material issues, and they kind of like, instead of just establishing that you didn't have a record, and so you can't make a rule from no record, they kind of come at it from another angle, and I don't understand why they do that.
Well, no, but I think it's a great question. Let me answer with another question, because that's what I do. Why would a court on one hand, given the option of saying, you got it wrong, this is the wrong policy because it turns whitefish to jello, but it bounces people out of work. Why would a court instead say, you use the wrong process to reach your decision, go back to it again? What's the difference between that?
Well, I wasn't necessarily saying the court would just say, you got the policy wrong, but instead of saying, you, on one hand, you did the process wrong because you didn't keep a contemporaneous record, which is what happened here.
Yeah.
But then they also go the extra step to say, and because you didn't have a record, you didn't notify people to make material comments, you therefore couldn't respond to material comments, when they could just stop it. You didn't have the right record.
I think it's a valid point. To a certain extent, it almost feels like dicta, doesn't it? You've already killed it, why kill it again? But I think, remember, it is the Second Circuit. There was always a possibility of appeal, that you have an independent ground for the decision. But I have to confess, at that point, I'm speculating. My sense is the record was so atrociously awful that they could have stopped after a couple of paragraphs. That's a personal thing. I'm sorry, Josh, you had
I was going to say, I think it's an example of the court being more activist. I don't know if activist is the right word, but at least less in that it's given the opportunity to clarify and define some of this informal procedure for an agency administration. And given that opportunity, it is clarifying some of those standards.
Okay.
And that's just a guess. I don't know how often these kind of cases come before the court, which might be a guess is not as frequently, at least at that level. And so, given.
Well, I wouldn't type this down because it's just history, it's not law. But this was actually during the heyday of the activist judicial review of administrative action.
Okay, is this Warren?
No, this is Second Circuit.
Oh, yeah.
But this is the J. Skelly Wright, the D.C. Circuit thing. There's a lot of activity in that front. Mike? I'm going to do something really terrible. It's a dereliction of professorial duty, and simply say Overton Park v. Volpe is one of the seminal cases of administrative law. It actually raises a lot of the same issues that we talked about with Josh, where the Department of Transportation tried to manufacture an ad hoc record after the fact. But it is focused on the way you have to have a hard look at the process an agency uses to reach its decision, rather than substance of it. So it sets the predicate for the Nova Scotia case problem. So essentially, I'm resisting the urge to go into it because it, you know, you will spend at least 2 days on this in the ad law class. We talk about it in the environmental law class. It's just that important. But the key thing is that it's teaching some of the same lessons we're talking about with Nova Scotia for our purposes today.
Well, I guess in this case, I understand why they're going outside of the record to buy stuff because there is no record. But
there are two ways to go after a rule. One is to sue the rule, sue the agency that promulgated the rule during the window after it's promulgated, and you attack its sufficiency under the APA. The other way to go after is when the agency sues you based on that rule, and you argue the rule is invalid. Now, Overton Park was not quite in that situation because it dealt with a funding decision. They were challenging that decision. But the bottom line is that you do have that second opportunity to attack the sufficient record and raise other information as part of that attack. But you know, the heavy caution here is that your window to introduce new information in the attack on a rule is rare and narrow. That helps.
Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I now have the exact opposite thought regarding why the court didn't follow this stuff. I was thinking perhaps Board is so cautious about, especially since it's a water board, they are so cautious about doing anything that would even like give the appearance of interfering with like agency discretion, mm-hmm. that and given the possibility of license cert being granted if they ever give us a Supreme Court, they're trying to offer as broad of a justification for why they're doing what they're doing, just so that they cover the grounds and don't affect the optics of like the judicial interference.
Sure, I can see that. And also, I could draw perhaps another analogy. How do appellate courts review district court decisions? They're only to the trial transcript, to the record. You're not allowed to present new evidence on appeal.
Right.
So there's some parallels here that give us a comfort of familiarity to the agency. But I still think at the end of the day, if you're really a believer in judicial economy, one or two would have been enough to put this rule on ice. But they put both to make sure it stayed on ice. On ice was not meant to be yet another pun. Okay. All right, so I want to make sure I hit one big, I'm sorry, Drew, but I was going to wrap up if you had something else.
Please.
No, that's right, go ahead.
Just as far as what constitutes a record, I know that note after the case says that all documents that are considered, not just the ones they rely on, and then it's basically two professors trying to compile from court holdings what constitutes a record. And I'm curious, is there a consensus as to what constitutes a record? Is that consensus, or is it something that's up for debate? Because they have three exclusions as well, like no business info, no internal notes, or something like that.
Yeah, I think the honest answer is that's two professors.
Okay.
My experience has been, what is the record gets driven by functional concerns. For example, one, going back to our gaming the system discussion, suppose I want to landmine the record. So I submit a 5-page letter, but then in a footnote, I incorporate by reference 80,000 pages of testimony and scientific studies. Is that incorporation by reference? Import all that into the record. Does the agency have to respond to all those reference attachments? And where does it end? You could end up with millions of pages incorporated by reference that way. Courts tend to use a materiality threshold to determine how much the agency has to keep looking. So those important reference documents are actually important to the decision. Yes. But yeah, whether or not it sort of fits a formal definition or if it's submitted in a particular way, the courts tend to be pretty pragmatic about that. So, if you submit a comment through an alternative means, orally, if you do it, I'm not sure if this is what you're asking for, but I've seen lots of stuff submitted as comments that don't look like comments, but the courts will still take it. As well. Does that help?
It helps somewhat. I'm just curious, the record, you're supposed to present, I guess, all of the stuff that you looked at, to show. It's supposed to kind of, expose whether or not your decision was arbitrary or capricious, mm-hmm. right? So, hiding things that are part of the record, isn't that, it would have to be some consensus as to what the record is, I guess, in order to.
Yeah, you have to hide it in a way that the court's going to think it's still part of the fair review of the regulation, if that's what you're asking. Okay.
I think we're getting there, but we're not going to get tested, I guess, on whether something's part of the record or not.
No, I usually don't ask evil test questions. So, that's okay. So I want to make sure I do two things. One is I want to give you one thought that this case varies, but it's really super important. What did the court do to this rule when it reached its decision? What did it say this rule was going to, what was going to happen to it? So, invalid, think about what that means. This rule is dead. When the court issued its mandate, this rule was unenforceable. It was basically, at that point, ceased to exist. That's not what happens to most rules. When you have a regulatory rulemaking challenge, judicial challenge to rulemaking, almost always what happens is the court determines the rule was promulgated in a deficient manner, but then it's remanded back to the agency for further consideration. Do it again. Here's the real catch. Almost always, the rule stays in effect during the review. So as a result, in this case, if we followed the standard operating procedure, the rule would have gone back to the FDA. The FDA would have done its testing to determine whether or not the temperature, salinity, and TSS, temperature, salinity, and salt temperature, can't remember now. The TSS, they would have tested it. They would have gotten more data. They would have probably extended for a rule a period of time. They would repropose the rule, taking comments, then the final rule. By the time the final rule came out, the whitefish industry would have been dead. So this is a case where the rule was void ab initio, basically dead on arrival when the court issued its mandate. Now, why am I mentioning that? 90% of the time, the rule is still in effect. A lot of times, two things happen. One, Pyrrhic victory. The court may issue a judgment in favor of the challenge to the rule, but most companies, most individuals, have already had to comply with the rule in the meantime. And we'll continue to comply with it during the remand and review. So that leads to number two. It has become increasingly important and increasingly prevalent that you seek an injunction to halt the application of the rule. That has played a particularly important role in the regulatory state, where important rules that are politically controversial get challenged, but then the actual trial, the actual fight takes place in an injunction hearing in a very short time period to freeze the status quo. If you lose the injunction, you basically lost the case. If you win the injunction, you won the case. I'm sorry, it's wrong.
Sorry, can you repeat the first one?
First one of what?
So the second one was the injunction.
Well, the first is Pyrrhic victory. P-Y-R-R-H-I-C. It means that you lose by winning. Yeah. Your victory is basically meaningless because you've won the battle but lost the war. You stormed the hill but you killed all of your troops doing it. That's what it meant. Okay, so with that, with our remaining 5 minutes, I'm going to try an experiment with you guys. Something I haven't done yet this semester. I'd like to ask someone to go ahead and volunteer now to pick up the discussion on Thursday on State Farm. Given such important, well, that was quick.
For Thursday.
All right, I feel compelled to give you the swag. And guys, like, this may be the best swag all semester.
Really?
Well, at least I like it. I want you to all think about why I would give this particular swag to this particular case. It's not a bar, I'm not Oprah. This is petrified wood.
Wait, don't give it to him until he dresses like Jane from State Farm.
Yeah. All right, you have the opportunity to challenge him on Thursday, and if you really do a better job talking about it, you're welcome to sort of move the class. All right, then.
Yeah, he's a red shirt.
How about this? I will have alternate swag that you can earn if you'd like to by jumping. Okay, so that's the question I want you guys to think about. Think about the process, think about Nova Scotia, but think about why I would give Huey a piece of petrified wood to capture the essence of State Farm Mutual Insurance Company. All right, and with that, questions, thoughts, ideas, suggestions before we turn to lunch hour? You do? Oh, you're ready for lunch hour?
Yes.
You're free. Thank you.